today, Guardian journalist Jenny Stevens on living with anorexia. Jenny, you've written about your 20-year battle with anorexia. How did you feel about your body as a child?
I was just always a bit frightened of food, I think. And I think that predated the body issues. I just didn't like flesh. I didn't like fat. And I somehow felt that both my mind and my body and me as a person was somehow wrong. I don't really remember a time when I felt okay about my body. I remember being really young at infant school and seeing my sort of tummy protrude a bit under my, I had like a little green school uniform, and just feeling really disgusted by that.
When Jenny Stevens looks back at her childhood, it wasn't obvious that she had an eating disorder at the time. But as she grew older, her fears about food developed into anorexia, which took over her life and eventually led to her being admitted to a psychiatric hospital. Now she's in recovery and able to talk about what happened to her. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the fight to recover from a lifelong eating disorder. Just a warning before we start. In this episode, there are references to suicide, which some might find distressing. Jenny, what was your childhood like?
You know, we didn't have very much money. You know, my parents bought a flat, sort of encouraged by this sort of Thatcher ideal that everybody should be a homeowner. And when I was 10, we were made homeless. My parents got into lots of negative equity on their flat as the house prices plummeted. The mortgage rates, you know, the interest rates had shot up, and they just couldn't afford the mortgage repayments. My parents went to court. We were given 24 hours to pack up all our stuff, everything we owned before the bailiffs came. And I just remember looking there and seeing the bailiffs just like literally take the telly away. These sort of men dressed in black just sort of taking everything away. And we had literally nowhere to go. And then we went into temporary accommodation. So essentially a homeless hostel. It was in Kemp Town in Brighton, which at the time was kind of famous for sort of crack, smack and sex, basically. You know, and we arrived at this hostel and it was like a scene from Trainspotting when we walked in. And, you know, no one had cleaned. There were Brillo pads all over the floor. You know, little Martell bottles where people had been smoking crack. There was used needles. There was blood all up the wall.
I mean, that's so scary. And you were so young. What impact did that have on you?
I think when something bad like that happens to you, there is this constant feeling that the world is not safe and that you are not safe in it. I think the fear of eating definitely, it really intensified around that period. I mean, obviously, I didn't want to eat in the hostel. I don't think anyone would have done. You know, it was dirty. It was full of needles and burnt bits of tinfoil and spoons. You know, it wasn't a nice environment to come back and have like a wholesome family dinner. You know, I don't think I stopped eating because I wanted to be thin, but I definitely found that this simple act of just shutting my mouth and not eating, there was a kind of, it was a tiny, tiny bit of control, and it made me feel somehow defiant and like I could conquer this sort of, it's a very basic human need. And if you can conquer that, then it makes you feel powerful in this very small way.
So looking back, is there a particular point that you can pinpoint when the eating disorder began, or was it something that was very gradual?
I don't remember a specific point where I was like, right, I have an eating disorder, or today I'm depressed. It's quite a messy, back and forth, not very linear thing. And it doesn't really make that much sense in a lot of ways, which is why it's quite tricky to sort of get a handle on it. But no, I don't remember a very specific time in my life when I, you know, when it started and when it got worse. But, you know, it always been there. It was always a part of me.
Do you think that media, the images that you saw as you were growing up, also played a part in how you felt about your body?
I'm not going to say it directly causes eating disorders, because I think that eating disorders are so much more than body image. Body image is just like the tip of the surface. I think I'd be lying if I said that the fact that the sort of ideal female body type was very thin and graceful and delicate, would I have sort of strived towards that? Had that not been the case? Well, no, like obviously I was an obsessive perfectionist. Not only did I want to prove that there was nothing wrong with me, but I wanted to be the best. I was kind of aggressively perfectionist about everything. And those images definitely played a part.
You've talked about trying to control your body at a time in your life when you didn't feel you had a lot of control. And I feel like this is something that could become really difficult in your teenage years. What was that period of your life like for you?
There is evidence to show that, you know, particularly in teenage years, during puberty, when your body's changing, that can be a real trigger period. That didn't really work that way with me. I was happy at school. I loved school. I had an amazing group of friends, many of whom are still some of my best friends now. So I really had a sort of home and a family. Yeah, you know, I had difficult times in my teenage years, but I think it happened a little bit later for me. I think I started to really sort of take control around food again, probably around my GCSEs. Moving up towards my A levels, I found college quite difficult to adapt to. Where big changes happen, that's always been a kind of trigger point for me.
What was your relationship with food like by the time you're in your 20s?
I moved around jobs a bit. So when I left uni, I worked in politics for a little bit. I worked for a gay rights charity. I still can't decide whether it was me or the sort of obsessive perfectionist push eating disorder part of me that was like, no, you need to go into journalism now. But you know, I was sort of throwing all my energy into work and retraining. I found it quite hard to get a job, but then I did get a job. I got a dream job. I worked at NME as a staff journalist there, and it was an amazing period of time, but it definitely didn't encourage me to sit down and eat three proper meals a day. You know, I was out at gigs every single night. I was at festivals. I would travel loads. I think it enabled me to sort of skip meals regularly. And I think initially the weight just sort of dropped off me quite naturally because I was really busy. But then the sort of darkness, you know, the madness inside took a grip of that, and I'd reached such a low body weight by that point that I just couldn't bear the idea of gaining any more weight. And that's when I think, you know, from about the age of 26 onwards is when the sort of anorexia really gripped and took hold in a way that I just couldn't shake.
If you look back on that time now, Jenny, is there a scene or a memory you have of a point where you realise how deep you were in your anorexia?
There's so many. It's like a tape reel of a really bad film of terrible behaviour. And I describe sort of my eating disorder as this kind of all-encompassing demon voice that's kind of aggressive and nasty and hateful. Because I think that's when life just really veered completely out of control. I think binge eating is really misunderstood. You know, people think that with restrictive eating disorders, you know, you just don't eat anything. I mean, you'd literally be dead in a very short space of time if that was the case. It's a crueler, slower demise. I think for me, once I started having occasional episodes of what I considered to be binge eating, what other people might call eating, my life just derailed. You know, there's so much shame around binge eating. It also meant that the amount that I was eating sort of in the daytime normally got less and less and less. So there were these sort of long periods of eating very little, which would then trigger more sort of binge eating behaviour. You know, I remember in these sort of periods where I just didn't have any control, I don't quite remember how I got to places. You know, that's terrifying. You are quite literally losing your mind by that point. You know, I was living in a shared house, like you'd end up sort of stealing food or lying about food. I remember going on buses to like 24-hour supermarkets to replace the food. There were times where I'd like wake up on park benches. I didn't know how I got there. And then I'd just drag myself to the swimming pool for when it opened at 6 a.m. and just swim length after length after length after length to like get it off of me. It was just such a lonely and horrible time in my life.
You used the word lonely there, and I think that's what I'm just imagining from everything you've just said. This sounds like terrifyingly isolating. I wonder how people around you responded during this time.
It's weird. I think I'd got very good at pretending by that point. I mean, obviously you think that no one knows, but everyone knows. Particularly when I was losing weight, I would often say, you know, I'm gluten-free, oh, I'm off sugar, or I'm vegan for a bit. You know, and that's very acceptable thing, and people kind of look up to you and think, oh wow, look, she's so controlled, she's got so much self-restraint, you know. So I was able to pat people away.
Your eating disorder then had taken over your life by this point, Jenny. When did you realize you might need to get some help to deal with it?
The physical effects of kind of long-term starvation had really got to me. Sort of heart palpitations, aches, pains, not being able to sleep, stomach aches, like the minor physical things, really. And I went to my GP and I told her, you know, that I'd cut out all these food groups, you know, it'd been, and, you know, I still didn't feel any better and I didn't really know what to eat. And, you know, now knowing everything that I do know about eating disorders, I was so obviously anorexic. I so obviously fulfilled every single diagnostic criteria for a diagnosis of an eating disorder. My GP knew that I had a problem. She sat there and asked me how many calories there were in a carrot. And I told her and she said, oh, well, you know what to eat. But I still feel really angry that at that point she didn't intervene and instead watched me flounder around and deteriorate for sort of two solid years, by which point I was kind of begging for anything, any treatment that was going, really. I mean, the difficulty with eating disorders is that they're not the kind of illnesses that you turn up to the doctor and say, hi, I'm anorexic, can you help me? And so that's why it's hard to seek help. And that's why there's not really a light bulb moment where you think, oh God, yeah, I'm really ill. It's sort of like a slow sort of fog clearing and you have these moments of real clarity and then you have these other moments where you're completely gripped by it again and you can't see anything. You know, it sounds really dramatic, but I never ever thought that I would be alive at the age of 35 talking to you like this. You know, I think I'd really reached the end of the line.
Which is awful. And clearly you were not getting anywhere near the support you needed. When did this begin to change?
So after about 2 years of my GP, she referred me to the community mental health team. Finally, I was seen by someone within a few months and the community mental health team, they referred me to St Anne's, which is an eating disorder unit in East London. I had to wait a few months and I had an initial assessment with a consultant psychiatrist there who sort of gave me a sort of official diagnosis, I guess. It was atypical anorexia, which just meant that all my behaviours were sort of anorexia. It's just that I had occasional binges, which meant that my body weight was larger than what would normally count for anorexia nervosa, which, as you can imagine, made me feel really great about myself. But yeah, she basically said to me, you were lied to by your GP. You know, you should have come straight here. Such a chaotic time for me. I didn't really have anywhere fixed to live. I eventually landed in Southeast London. And because it had taken me so long to see someone in an eating disorders unit, I didn't want to sort of leave. Because the problem is when, you know, this was 2017, when you move NHS trusts. So I was going from the trust where St Anne's is down to South London and Maudsley Trust, SLAM. That is a really rocky process. And so what happened? She said, no, don't worry, I'll refer you straight to the eating disorders unit at the Maudsley. It'll be fine. For whatever reason, they couldn't make a direct referral, a service-to-service referral. So I found myself in a new place to live without any of my notes, having to register for a new GP and having to start that entire process right from the beginning. And so I found myself in a corner shop paying like 10p a sheet to photocopy like 60 pages of psychiatric reports to give to people that were supposed to be, you know, health professionals, you know. And this is like, you're completely losing your mind by this point, and you're saying to people, I want to die, I'm harming myself and I'm frightened. And they're just like, so uninterested. By this point as well, I should say that I'd been seen by a psychiatrist in the community mental health team who had refused to make the referral to the Maudsley, which had come from another consultant psychiatrist, because he didn't feel like it, basically. I mean, he looked me up and down. He said, women like you want it all. You want the perfect career. You want to be thin, and you can't have it all. And, you know, I see women like you a lot come looking for a diagnosis that I can't give you.
Oh, God.
Which is so frustrating, because you're almost being gaslit by the psychiatrist by this point, because you've got a diagnosis. You're not looking for one. You're just asking for him to sign the bit of paper to make the referral that you should have had a year ago. And then an amazing thing happened, which is I had an appointment with my GP, and I arrived and the receptionist was like, your appointment was yesterday, you've missed it. And I just started crying, and this lovely receptionist just said, oh, just sit down there for a minute, we might have an on-call doctor. I remember walking into this doctor's office with Dr. Stevens, who is still my GP and who is lovely, and she had on a really nice dress and nice earrings. And she sat and she listened to me, and she said, this is appalling. And she said, we'll take care of this, and I want to see you every week. She raised a care quality alert, which is concern that you think a patient's in danger, and she did that. There's only a couple of moments in my entire sort of journey with this where things really did change in that instant. She basically completely saved my life.
Coming up, Jenny begins her journey of recovery. Jenny, it took 4 years after that first visit to the GP, but you were eventually referred to a daycare programme in the eating disorder unit at the Maudsley, which is a psychiatric hospital in South London. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of terrified of going into the Maudsley. I mean, no one really wants to say, yes, I'm going to quit my job and go into full-time psychiatric care. You come in at 10... and you sit round a table and you go to the kitchen and you get your milk and a biscuit, and there'll be someone there telling you to fill up your milk a little bit more because you've only poured yourself half a cup. No, a bit more milk. No, come on, you're taking the piss now. Just fill the milk cup up, sit down, eat the biscuit. Then there were lots of sort of throughout the day group sessions, therapy sessions. We did stuff around sort of managing perfectionism. There was a lot of stuff about sort of assertiveness and communication, because I think lots of people with anorexia particularly, or other eating disorders, for me certainly, you know, being thin was a way of communicating how I felt. So what's a healthier way of sort of dealing with anger or grief? And there was something really powerful, I think, about being there with other people who were similar to you.
Did the process work for you? I mean, did you start to feel like you were recovering in some way?
No, I mean, it gets a lot worse before it gets better. You know, I'm sure anyone will tell you, if they're sort of trying to get better from an eating disorder, it's horrible. Think about it now, my whole body shudders. You know, the weight gain is intolerable. And a lot of it, you know, a lot of what being in daycare is, and it's the same with inpatient care, is you sit and you eat and you tolerate. And I was eating more than I'd eaten in a very long time. I was being watched eating it. I couldn't spit any of it out. I couldn't hide any of it. You know, these sort of disordered eating behaviours, they were really stamped out. And that process of dismantling the hold that, you know, really pulling away at the tendrils of an eating disorder is excruciating, actually, for a long time. But then, you know, you have these moments of clarity where you see a vision of what your life might be like if it wasn't there, or if it was just a bit quieter.
Do you remember the day you were discharged?
Yeah, I left the hospital, and it was like this sort of blanket of snow. It sounds really cheesy, but it felt like the ground was sort of laid for something. It felt like a good image, you know. It was sort of a metaphor for something, that it was this blanket of clean snow, and I could sort of, you know, it felt like a sort of fresh start in a way.
Yeah, it felt hopeful.
Yeah, it did. And you know what? I was not cured when I left hospital. And I think the real work started when I left, because then you're making those decisions for yourself every single day and every single minute or second.
Jenny, you've talked about your battle to get treatment for your anorexia. Do you think things might have been different if you'd had access to private healthcare?
Yes, 100%. I think one of my frustrations, particularly when I started in daycare, was that some people hadn't actually had to wait that long. And I really didn't understand why. And then I realised that it was because they'd had private assessments. You know, if I'd had the money, or my family had had the money, would I have, you know, I'm not saying that I wouldn't have done that, but I don't think it's fair.
Did you feel angry about that?
Yeah, I was so angry. So angry. And I think anger is something that's always driven my eating disorder. You know, there is so much in our society that is arbitrary and unfair in terms of sort of health inequality and access to care as well. You know, it is this giant postcode lottery. Only one third of NHS trusts have a daycare service, like I was so lucky to have access to.
Do you think the fact that this is an illness that predominantly affects women explains a bit why it's dealt with in this way?
I think you just got to be really careful, because if we only see eating disorders as things that posh white women get, then that fails everybody else who suffers from them. I don't believe that eating disorders discriminate, but how we identify it and how we treat it, that's where the discrimination comes in.
There've been a few points in this interview, Jenny, when I've been thinking about how your treatment would have been different if you'd received it during this pandemic. How has COVID affected the services and support that is available for people with eating disorders?
I mean, I can't say how different it would have been. And I think I still would have got something out of it. I don't want to put anybody off of trying to access treatment because of it. But, you know, I think the main impact that COVID has is that I think it's made a lot of people face up to their eating disorders. I think lots of people are realising that they have a problem. You know, I think it's important to be aware that eating disorders really, really thrive on isolation. They sort of push you away from people. And I think that if you have to go to work, or you want to maintain friendships, or you want to see people, there is an element of like, at some point you're going to have to eat something, or you're going to have to, you know, break out of the control cycle ever so slightly to do those things. But if you're actually just trapped in the house all the time and you can't leave, I worry that that's the perfect opportunity for eating disorders to really flourish and really, really take hold. And I just worry that maybe people who had sort of milder, less serious problems, that it would progress in this sort of petri dish of isolation.
Jenny, it's been nearly 3 years since you left the Maudsley. How are you feeling now?
Yeah, this sort of changes on a minute-to-minute basis. I'm not going to pretend that my life is perfect, and I'm not going to pretend that I skipped out of hospital into a sort of horizon and, you know, was happily ever after, because that's not what happened. I rely on the support of friends and family a lot. I still really struggle with mental illness. Still see a psychiatrist, still see a therapist, still take the medication. I think food and the way I feel about my body probably occupies about 70% of my thinking, but that's a real bit of progress from the sort of 99% that it occupied. And, you know, I can see joy in things, and I can enjoy things, and I can laugh, and I can focus on conversations that people are having, and I can work again, and there was a lot of period of my life where I thought, it's not worth it. I can't live like this. I can't live unless I am like this. If I gained weight, I would die. This is all I have. You know, it gives you this enormous drive and purpose having an eating disorder. I think people who have addictions say the same thing. You know, it's a reason to get up every day. And that was a real struggle for a while, but I see joy now, and I didn't see joy in anything before. And I think that's really worth it.
Jenny, thank you so much for speaking to me.
No, thank you so much for having me and letting me talk.
That was Jenny Stevens. I really do recommend going to theguardian.com to read her story called I Was at War with My Body, My Year as a Day Patient on an Eating Disorders Ward. If you've been affected by anything that we talked about in this episode, support is available. The UK Eating Disorder charity BEAT can be contacted on 0808 801 0677. And their website is beatingdisorders.org.uk. The Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123 or email jo@samaritans.org. You can also find a list of international helplines at www.befrienders.org. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Marta van der Wolf, and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.